This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. I grew up in the suburbs, the kind that got built in the 1970s, the ones that threw away the urban conventions like sidewalks and shared space in favor of big lots cut into woods and farms. Suburbs like these grew as if on steroids in the decades that followed, with grander lawns and entranceways, pools and backyard trampolines, McMansions that dwarfed the old split-level ranch ideals of my youth. But a funny thing has happened, says Lee Gallagher. The trend line hasn't continued. In fact, there's a lot of suburban life that's gotten less appealing while cities are working hard to draw people back to an old style of urban living. Today, Where We Live, we will tackle some big ideas surrounding urbanism and suburbanism. We'll talk about planning in mega regions like the ones we live in right here, where lives are connected across state boundaries in a way that might prompt a new way of planning in the future. We'll also talk to a UConn professor who is studying street network patterns and what kinds of cities might actually be better for your health. You can always join our conversation, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, WNPR.org, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. We're going to start with Lee Gallagher, who's an editor at Fortune magazine, an author of The End of the Suburbs, Where the American Dream is Moving. Lee joins us by phone. Lee Gallagher, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you, John. Thank you for having me.
So when did we first start to notice the shift away from the suburban ideal that I grew up with?
Well, you know, it's funny. It really, to get wonky about it, it kind of started with a ruling that really engineered out the sort of liveliness and organic kind of traditional urban planning standards that most suburbs were originally built on. And it really happened after World War II. That's when officially we kind of ushered in the more modern suburban model, which is, as you rightfully explained, the kind of, you know, cookie cutter houses, minimal sidewalks, and that really did go on steroids and turn into more modern urban sprawl, which is best known for this sort of, you know, cul-de-sacs, strip malls, highway interchanges connecting everything, the more kind of sprawly suburbs that are really more common now than the charming old towns that made up our original suburbs so long ago.
The thing with sprawl is, and we've covered sprawl and suburban sprawl on our program quite a bit, is it seems as though, even though some of these ideals seem somewhat outdated, that maybe the McMansion isn't as cool as it once was for a young up-and-coming couple who are going to have 2.5 kids. At the end of the day, we still are creating these environments, even as your book suggests, more people are seeking an urban lifestyle. What can you tell us about the trends right now in 2014? Where are people moving?
What gives? It's funny because, you know, people come to me and they say, well, but there's this new subdivision that's being built right down the street. This isn't, you know, you're not right. The suburbs aren't ending. And, you know, it's true that this kind of building is still happening in many places because it's so built into the financing and the way that housing and development is financed. It's much easier to build the way we've been building for 50 years than to do something new and different. But we're starting to see very tangibly changes in what the consumer wants, what the home buyer wants, and changes in what developers are starting to offer. So, you know, the McMansion had its moment, and yes, some are still being built, but in general, there is a movement away. You know, so many people no longer want to spend their weekends caring for a huge lawn, spend all the money that it costs to heat and cool a large house. There's a trend in home building to kind of combine the living and dining room into great rooms. That's really popular these days. We're even seeing things like porches become more popular and decks in the back becoming less popular. So it all plays into a trend of wanting to, you know, spend more time in the space that you have, don't have unused space, and also spend more time with the people both that you live with and the people in your community.
And that also means less time maybe in the car by yourself. You tell stories in your book about these mega commutes that people, especially in California, have taken for years because they can't afford the suburban ideal in the proper community that they've always wanted to live in. So they go 70 miles outside, spending 3 hours in the car. That's just not appealing to people's lives anymore.
It's not. It impacts people's lifestyles in a major way. You know, there's the whole sort of drive to you qualify phenomenon, which so strong is the American dream of owning a house, it has been up until now, I'll say, that, you know, people were willing to drive 2-3 hours one way each day just so that they could afford the kind of their piece of the American dream, a house and a lawn. And people are really punishing themselves, as you mentioned. I mean, I talked to so many people about this, and the irony I found is that so often people think that they're prioritizing the family. You want to give your kids a lawn to play around on, and you want to give them the best schools and the best lifestyle. But when you are, especially for a dual working parent household, if both parents are doing that kind of commute, you're really removing from that lifestyle time with the children in such a big way that it's actually deprioritizing the very thing that they think they're prioritizing.
The other piece of this is the ideal is this big lawn gives you and the kids a place to play around, and that's got to be healthy and full of exercise. But as you say in your book, and we've certainly talked about on the program before, if you're in an urban environment, just by the very nature of how you have to get around, you're walking 3/4 of a mile, 2 miles to places every day. In the suburbs, you know what? It's pretty easy to just get in the car in the garage, pop open the door, and then drive anywhere you need to go. The people in the suburbs are just a lot less healthy.
It's true. There's a tremendous difference between people who live in more urban environments, and even if that's a more urban suburb where you can actually get out of the car and walk around to do stuff, and these car-oriented suburbs, which really make up the predominant majority of suburbs today. People get in their car for almost everything. We've, again, kind of engineered walking out of our lifestyles, and that takes a tremendous toll on our health and also our relationships. I mean, you know, we've long said goodbye to the days when people really knew their neighbors in a fundamental way. And I'm generalizing here, but, you know, there's one person in my book who says, I know more about the person I sat next to on a plane yesterday than the neighbor I've lived next to for 5 years. And I think a lot of people will really identify with that because, you know, again, people think they're moving to the suburbs for community. And while that exists in many places, it really has gone away in a pretty significant fashion.
Of course, something we've heard from urban residents in cities like Hartford in the past, Lee, is it's very true. We talk about walkability and dense urban communities as being the model of new urbanism. For a lot of people who've lived in cities their entire lives, they say, you know what, yeah, it's great to get to walk every place, but it takes me way too long to walk to the grocery store. I'd like to be able to catch a bus and go someplace now and again. Are we sometimes thinking about this new urban model in a way that maybe replicates some suburban lifestyle characteristics as opposed to really solving the problems that are in cities? Like, people can't get around all that well. They do have to walk too far.
You know what? That's a great point. I mean, there are a lot of experiments going up right now. A lot of developers are trying to solve this problem, and many of them are in the new urbanist mold of building kind of little villages still in the middle of the suburbs. And so many of them are brand new, and you know, they offer a lot of amenities right there. But yeah, you've got to get in your car to go anywhere else. I talked to Ken Jackson, who wrote the wonderful Crabgrass Frontier, a seminal book on the history of the suburbs in my book, and he says, you know, it doesn't pass the mattress test. You know, unless you can get a mattress, you know, you can get an ice cream cone and you can get lots of, you know, cute, fun things, but you can't really solve your true day-to-day needs for living in many of these communities. And that's true. But on the other hand, I'll say they're just throwing things at the wall to see what sticks. And the important thing, I think, is to pay attention to all of the energy that's being expended right now to try to fill some of these holes in whatever way possible. Because there's no one-size-fits-all solution. That's what the suburbs tried to be, and that's a big reason why it didn't work. So when we see these urbanist communities going up in the middle of the suburbs, I say, great, you know, it's trying. Not everyone has to live there. Not everyone has to live in a big skyscraper in Manhattan. You know, the important thing is coming up with different types of options for everyone.
This whole idea of a mattress test is fascinating to me because as much as we talk about the value of the creative class, at the end of the day, Lee, you know, you can't do everything in that beautiful coffee shop down the street. Sometimes you just got to buy some stuff at the grocery store, right?
It's true. That's absolutely true. Yes.
Lee Gallagher is from Fortune magazine, and she's the author of The End of the Suburbs, Where the American Dream is Moving. It's a fascinating book about one of our favorite topics. Lee, thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, John.
When we come back, we're going to talk to a few Michigan professors who are looking at mega regions, like the one we live in, the one that they live in the Great Lakes, and how we're planning in mega regions. These are regions that don't necessarily stop at state or national borders. We're going to find out about that type of urban planning next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're looking at some of the ways we live today, urban and suburban. We just talked with Lee Gallagher, whose new book is The End of the Suburbs, Where the American Dream is Moving. Coming up later, we'll talk to our friend Norm Garrick from the University of Connecticut to talk about the research he's done on streetscapes, maybe some streetscapes keeping us a bit healthier. But next, we're going to turn to a few researchers and architects who look at megaregions. Jeffrey Toon and Kathy Velikov are both part of an exhibit that's coming to Yale School of Architecture. Infra Ecology Urbanism looks at the Great Lakes megaregion of North America. They join us both from Michigan Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan today. Jeffrey and Kathy, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, it's a pleasure to be here.
I'm wondering if you can describe for me, first of all, what a megaregion is. Give us a definition.
Well, a megaregion is a continuously developed urban area that's characterized by multiple city centers that are connected with continuous development in between, and that can be a kind of mix of suburban sprawl, low-density industrial areas, and also smaller kind of small-scale and medium-sized cities. And so they're connected with continuous development, and they share kind of integrated labor markets, infrastructure, land use, as well as interdependent networks of transportation, often economies, as well as ecologies and cultures. And so they're a kind of complex urban agglomeration.
The one that you study, the one that you're in, the Great Lakes megaregion, maybe you can put a border around it for us. Give us a definition of what that is. Where does it start? Where does it stop?
Well, that's actually borders is one of the biggest points of contention for planners and economists who really study and try to define megaregions, and so there are multiple ways of trying to put borders on these regions. One is looking at transportation and commuting, and so the Great Lakes megaregion can really be defined by the major cities of Chicago, Detroit, Pittsburgh, Toledo, Toronto, Buffalo, and in some cases stretches all the way down to St. Louis as a kind of urban territory. However, if you look at it in a slightly different way, you can also encompass the entire Great Lakes watershed as part of this mega region, because it's not just about where people are living, but it's also the ecology that is affecting those people's lives and the industries that are in the region.
One of the things that's fascinating to me is, as I said at the top of the show, and people who listen to the show know, I grew up in Pittsburgh, which is a place that seems right on the border between the Midwest and the East. And being part of this Great Lakes megaregion seems just about right for me culturally in some ways. It seems right to me in terms of architecture and the way some of these cities work. But what are some of the other things that draw together disparate communities into one megaregion? Describe the history, perhaps, of how a place like this gets built and gets tied together in a way that actually could be defined as a megaregion.
Well, it's interesting. If we think about the kind of shared and underlying geological conditions that support in many ways the emergence of, let's say, industrialization in the last century, we can think about the relationship between the Great Lakes as a system of waterways that precipitate transportation, the supply of fresh water, and the abundance of energy within our megaregion, for example, coming both from coal reserves and from hydroelectric power. As giving rise to a very particular form of cultural activity as well as economic activity that then begins to birth certain cities. So if we summon a term such as the Rust Belt, it produces a kind of imaginary that I think in many ways would kind of develop a kind of context for similar patterns of civic life, similar relationships between residential areas and the kinds of industries that were facilitated and enabled by the watershed as a primary distribution of heavy raw materials for refined manufacturing. And the kind of cascading issues that emerge from that also probably begin to resonate the concentration of capital and venture capital, particularly within the last century, that begin to give rise to philanthropic activities that yield, let's say, the concentration of public research universities that we would recognize within the mega region would be another familiarity. So these kinds of patterns that produce similar underlying activities that then begin to produce certain forms of public life resonate in many ways when we start to talk about this with people relative to their personal experiences.
We're talking today about urbanism and suburbanism and the way we live today in three different conversations. We're talking with Jeffrey Toon, who's an associate professor of architecture at the Taubman College of Architecture and Urban Planning at the University of Michigan, also a partner and at RVTR. Kathy Velikov also joins us, an assistant professor of architecture at the Taubman College and a principal at RVTR. They're part of an exhibit that's coming to the Yale School of Architecture, Infra-Ecologic Urbanism, and it's taking a look at the mega region of the Great Lakes, but there's other mega regions like ours as well. And maybe you can describe the mega region that we're part of. I'm sitting here in Connecticut, which is famously between Boston and New York, but our mega region seems to stretch up and down the East Coast, and we think about this continuum sort of like the Amtrak line that goes from Boston all the way down to Washington, D.C. Is that about what our mega region is, or is it more expansive than that?
Actually, that's been historically what about the extent of the what's called the northeastern seaboard, the northeastern mega region. And what's interesting, actually, about your mega region is that it was really one of the first identified mega regions when this kind of urban formation was first started to be theorized by a French geographer named Jean Gottman, who in 1961 wrote a book called Megalopolis, the urbanized northeastern seaboard of the United States. And he was really looking at the territory that you're living in right now and trying to analyze how the cities were being interconnected, how you couldn't really talk about cities as coherent bounded entities anymore, and where and how to even draw the boundaries with resource territories, with territories that supply those cities with raw materials, manufacturing territories, and all of those interconnections that are part of what he called the megalopolis, and now more recently the scholars studying this formation have called it the mega region, and as I said earlier, the exact boundaries vary depending on who is studying the urban phenomenon, and there is actually quite a few different agencies studying the urban phenomenon at different universities. For listeners that are interested, actually, you can go online to America 2050, and that's a kind of website run by the Regional Plan Association that's been studying mega regions for quite some time, and they have a lot of resources on the boundaries, economics, and dynamics of mega regions as a kind of the future of what America is going to look like.
If you have questions about the mega region we live in or this idea of how we might need to plan differently, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can always email us wherewelive@wnpr.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I want to get to some of the issues that mega regions like ours or like the Great Lakes face. I think about energy and transportation in our area. I think about things like water in California in the Southwest. But one thing that's interesting to us here in the Northeast that's fascinating, it's a little different than every place else, is say in California, there's a mega region that encompasses a number of different communities, but is almost entirely within one state. So there are political boundaries that can at least match the boundaries of what the mega region broadly is. Whereas here we've got 6, 7, 8, 9 states involved in one mega region, meaning that it's really hard to draw up these plans about when somebody's road ends and somebody else's road begins, how we get energy from one place to another, how we make sure that we're actually taking care of our air and our water across all these different governmental structures. I mean, this is a big problem for our mega region, I think.
Well, and it's even more exacerbated in the area where we're operating, where it includes transnational boundaries as well. So this question of how to produce cooperative frameworks that can operate in transnational, interprovincial, multi-state, intermunicipal kind of relationships, and the idea of producing formats of cooperation which are conceived of in the interests of the multiplicity of interested parties is a fairly radical framework for thinking about these territories. And in many ways, that's the kind of point of leverage, certainly from which our work begins. At the moment when we need to begin to consider the fundamental framework of governance, understanding and apprehending the nature of the systems within a megaregion, it also opens up a tremendous territory of possibility for reimagining many of the other dimensions that constitute our lives and the design and planning of these territories.
Indeed. And
go ahead.
Sorry.
No, please.
That's something that we're kind of very interested in, not only in just the planning, because we're designers as opposed to planners traditionally. But we're kind of interested in the kinds of cooperation that needs to occur in order to overcome some of the larger problems that we're facing that also don't have that aren't bounded by, let's say, state or city borders. And so storm surge is something that's not just a problem for New York City or New Jersey, and it's not a problem that one city can solve alone. I think the entire northeastern seaboard needs to deal with that environmental problem. Likewise, in the Great Lakes, the algae bloom is not just a problem for Toledo. It's actually a problem for the whole ecosystem of the Great Lakes and a lot of the kind of dynamics that cross both borders in multiple states.
And I was going to bring that up. That is a fascinating case in point, where we hear the stories coming from Toledo because on the ground, the people in that city have been unable to drink this cloudy water because of these algae blooms. But indeed, you're right. This points to a larger problem that affects tens of millions of people, both in the United States and in Canada. So what's that new way of thinking about it? From a design standpoint, how do we actually get these governmental structures to work to solve a problem that right now is rearing its head in Toledo, but very well could be in Cleveland and Toronto and in Minneapolis and every place else in the next year or so?
Well, we don't have the answer, but what we've been trying to do is to even bring this up as a conversation and to use design and research and visualization as a way to even kind of discuss these problems. Because in order to even discuss this as an issue or start to approach it, people need to start to understand the breadth of the issues involved, the dynamics that are involved, and even start to debate what the approaches might be. So the exhibition that is opening at Yale next week is an exhibition of research, analysis, and design within the Great Lakes megaregion that we've done over the past 5 years. And it's really both a way of looking at the megaregion, but also provoking discourse through kind of design proposals that don't purport to, let's say, solve these problems, but just to instigate kind of debate, conversation about the topic. And that's what we hope to do with the exhibition.
Give us an idea of a design proposal that perhaps people might be able to encounter at this exhibit that would get one of these conversations started. No better place to start a conversation than a public radio talk show, I suppose.
Well, indeed. One of the During the work and the development of the work, which has occurred over about 4 years, there was a fairly extensive period of analysis where we were trying to uncover and understand and then visually represent, in order to produce kind of collective apprehension of the networked interrelated systems that comprise the region. And one of the fascinating things, actually, is the examination of existing energy systems within the region and the existing potential for renewable energy capture within the region, which is primarily concentrated in the offshore wind reserves that overlay directly the Great Lakes megaregion. So we began to think about that territory as mobilized through an extended network of wind capture. As soon as we start to think about these kind of natural resources and their collective management, since they're kind of orphaned and floating above the Great Lakes, we can start to think collectively about the concept of research, capture, and distribution. When we begin to think that way, we can start to think about how to reframe and reconsider the concepts of profits yielded from renewable energy. And we began to examine the concept of extending those profits to produce public infrastructure and social infrastructure conceived of for a citizenry at the scale of the mega region. So in many ways, we work from resource-based flows towards the idea of social delivery of services as a kind of preliminary framework. We then, for example, also began to look at issues of mobility within the region. What are the infra-regional movements happening between cities in the region, and looking at alternatives, for example, to the extensive infra-regional airflows. And this is a contentious discussion at the moment in the United States, but the idea of high-speed rail, which is particularly effective in connecting cities within an 800-kilometer distance as an alternative to airflow, then begins to become an infrastructural system that we can examine and look at how the overlay of new formats of infrastructure might sponsor new kind of civic and institutional structures within the region. So
Yeah, I just want to quickly say that I love the idea of bringing up high-speed rail. We talk about it often here because in Connecticut, we're in this corridor where we have an attempt by Amtrak at what we call high-speed rail that isn't truly high-speed. And plans are on the drawing board for high-speed rail that may come sometime in the next 40 or 50 years of the type that we have in Europe or we have in Japan. We are looking at some higher-speed rail commuter connections between cities like Springfield and Hartford and New Haven, and it's something that's constantly on the drawing board. So you can make a very good case for it, but here's the thing I want to get to that always rears its head, whether it's in our region or your region or any region in the world that is considered a mega region. Not in my backyard is a very powerful idea that when you cite the wind turbine that may be for the collective good, when you cite the high-speed rail that's got to tear through somebody's town in order to get two people to better places more quickly, it has a lot of resistance and it's a lot of political will to get that done. How does the design aspect of what you're doing get around that, get through that barrier that seems to always be there towards some of these big collective projects that might benefit us all?
Well, I think the answer to approaching those questions would be specific and differentiated between various regions. But during our examination of the Great Lakes regions, one of the astonishing underlying infrastructures that sponsors the shape of the current region is explicitly the interstate highway system. And the organizational framework in the United States as a kind of extremely dense distribution of mobility, as compared to the highway system in Canada, particularly in southern Ontario, in which there's only really a single line of highway that traverses the area between Montreal, Toronto, on its way to connecting to Detroit. So within the kind of framework of examining the availability of public lands within our project, one of the kind of leverage points was to look at the very limited number of entities that own and manage the territory associated with the highway itself, and as a kind of infrastructural backbone specifically connecting primary areas of development, it seemed like a particularly logical place to imagine overlaying alternate systems. Those would include, for example, other vectors of movement like high-speed rail, but it might also privilege the distribution backbone for renewable energy resources and waste distribution and storage.
Another thing I want to get to quickly before I run low on time with you folks is a bit of the conversation that I had at the start of the show with Fortune Magazine's Lee Gallagher about some of the trends in America of people moving out of suburban ideal settings that were built throughout the 1950s, 60s, and 70s and now are not as desirable. When you think about the ways people want to live, today, whether or not the trend is to live in a more urban setting versus a more suburban setting, whether they crave rural life. How does this fit into some of the research that you do in how to plan for and how to design for mega regions? People's tastes seem to be changing rapidly in terms of what they believe the American or even the Canadian dream is.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And I think near the end of your discussion with Lee, she brought up this question of access to things that, and she called, you know, she described it as the kind of the mattress test. Mm-hmm. But I think no matter where people are living right now, one of the most important criteria for them is to have access to the things they need. So and so planning cities around that question is for the people we're working with right now and the researchers that we're talking with and the planners. That's one of the most important considerations, and it's a kind of a very different design question than, let's say, thinking about simply mobility, which just connects things, but actually figuring out what you're connecting and how people can get to it easily, affordably, equitably, and so in our project we were really thinking about this question of access along this line, because it has really structured a lot of the urban development, and there's a lot of development in close proximity to the highway, and also thinking about what other infrastructures or designs you can start to provide close to that line if you start to think about it as an artery of access. And so that's where some of the design proposals that we have in the show start, what they start to address.
I think the other issue that relates to this idea of a mega regional dream, if you will, that builds upon the critique that Lee levels at the suburb, is this transformation that we see might be underway already, evidenced by the kinds of millennials embracing of shared economies, has to do with the fact that the kind of provision of the dream for the individual through the means of individuals might be seeing to come to an end or to an exhaustion of its potential. And I think there's a thirst amongst people to imagine what new formats of collective life and collective access they can produce. We see this in dense urban cities across the United States, across the West, but we're also starting to see it in the perimeter. New ways of not conceiving of providing of the desires of life through the capital capacity of individuals. Not in your own backyard, together somewhere in the region.
And all of this in many ways sounds fascinating and wonderful. And the one issue that I have, we talk about politics on the show an awful lot, and what you just said I think can go into an awful lot of state houses or even on Capitol Hill in Washington, and people will say, oh, you want us to live in a collective, huh? You want us to all share resources. What does that sound an awful lot like? And I think that's maybe one of the political problems with some of what you're talking about. How do we break through a political mindset that says, you know, at the end of the day, we all should have our own stuff and take care of our own stuff, and we don't need to build for everyone. I need to build for me and in my backyard.
Well, I think the way it's actually happening is just through the market, actually, with phenomena like Uber, Lyft, Airbnb. Those are actually alternative markets based on sharing, and there is no kind of ideology that underlies it as a kind of the kind of contentious politics in the history.
That's
of,
right. It just works
of
better.
Social politics. Yeah. Yeah, and it works better for a lot of people. And so I think there is a market that the market is actually making that happen, probably before, you know, and before policy and politics are.
Well, it's a fascinating conversation. I think it's a fascinating exhibit too. Infra Ecology Urbanism will be on view from August 25th through November 20th at the Yale School of Architecture in New Haven. You can learn more by visiting our website, wnpr.org. I want to thank our guests, Kathy Velikov and Jeffrey Toon. They're both professors of architecture at the University of Michigan and also from RVTR. They both joined us from our friends at Michigan Radio in Ann Arbor. Jeffrey and Kathy, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
When we come back, we're going to talk to our friend Norman Garrick, who drops by to talk about these issues with us. He's from the University of Connecticut. He's been looking at streetscapes in cities, how they might even affect your health. That's next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, this week's shocking news out of Ferguson, Missouri, got us thinking a lot about the role and responsibility of police officers in our communities. We will take a look at some of the tactics being employed by law enforcement today and ask, what exactly is the role of police? When does that role go too far? You can join that conversation coming up on Monday on Where We Live. Today we're talking about the way we live today. We've been talking about suburbs versus cities and mega regions, what exactly they are and how we can design differently for them. Next, we're going to talk about street networks, something that Norman Garrick is looking at. He's an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Connecticut. He's been here before to talk with us about transportation and about parking, and now you're looking at street networks. Norman, good to see you once again. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, John. Thank you for having me back.
Maybe you can explain a little bit about what you're talking about when you say a street network. What do you mean?
Well, the street network is the basis on which we build communities. So you have different patterns, such as we have in West Hartford or Hartford. These were the connected, compact patterns that were used for hundreds of years all over the world. And that's in comparison to what you see in the newer suburbs, like the cul-de-sac patterns with big arterials connected to cul-de-sacs.
So tell us about the research that you were doing.
So this is the latest in a long line of research. We started looking at this about 5 years ago, where we were trying to understand why some cities had such a higher rate of traffic fatalities. And one of the things we found was that older cities had a much lower rate of traffic fatalities. And then we expanded the study to look at how people moved around in these different cities. And we found that there were some cities where it was much easier to walk and to bike and to take transit. And of course, there has been a long line of research that says that places where you have active transportation are does have an effect on people's health, obesity, diabetics, such outcomes like that.
So when you're talking about the older streetscapes, the ones that have been around for a very long time, colonial streetscapes like the ones that we see all over New England, they are advantageous in what way? How do they keep us healthier?
Well, it's the newer cities were built with the idea that everybody was going to get around by driving. So you'll have people in cars for everything, for going down the road to get a pint of milk, for going to schools, etc. And so we basically designed out active transportation and active exercise that people could get in their daily activities.
The other piece of this, though, is traffic fatalities. I mean, streetscapes that are places that are safe for people to walk versus places where they may very well get run over by a car if they're not careful.
That's definitely true. These places, the newer places are much less safe, and not just for pedestrians, but also for people in cars. That's one of the surprises of our research, is that for a long time we were told that we were designing safer places, but yet we're finding that these places are not even safe for people in cars.
We're talking with Norman Garrick, and he is an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Connecticut. And we're talking about urban and suburban landscapes, streetscapes on our program today. We've been talking about mega regions, which I want to ask Norm about in just a moment. But I do want to ask about the street networks that you looked at in California versus here in Connecticut. What's different about California than what we see here in terms of the way our street networks are laid out?
California is not different. The patterns we see all over the country are the same. We see similar, the patterns I mentioned in West Hartford. We see that in California. The reason we chose California was that it was a state with many, many cities because of its sheer size, and there were a large variety of different types of places. And we wanted to stay in a particular state because we were assured then that the data that we were using was comparable.
One of the things that is different between California and Connecticut, and I've noticed this every time I've gone to the West Coast, is that people's attitudes toward the car is just very different. For one thing, in a lot of California cities, you just expect that you're going to drive every place, and there's hardly any place that you get around by transit. The other thing is the way people walk on the streets is very much different. You stop at stoplights, and you wait until the light turns green. You don't just dash across. There is some cultural differences, I think, between the two places, right?
Well, actually, that's not strictly true. There are places in California that are as you described. But actually, the reason why I went to California in the first place was for Davis, California, where 20%, more than 20% of people get to work on bikes. And that was what drew me to California in the first place. This was such an unusual place, even for California.
So we just got done with a conversation about mega regions, and I'd love to actually hear some of your thoughts about that, because one of the important things about the type of design we're talking about, making better cities or even better suburbs, is that they don't exist in a vacuum, right? They have to be tied together in some ways. We talked with our previous guest about high-speed transit, something I know you and I have talked a lot about the highway system. But I guess I'm wondering if you could just give me some of your thoughts about this, some of the things you've learned about the way cities are laid out and how we might better weave them together so that they don't just work individually like Davis, California, but they actually work within a region.
Yeah, well, I think the regional thinking is important, and I really enjoyed the conversation earlier, and the idea that there are problems that need to be solved at a regional level is important. The problem with that thinking is that we can take it too far and not understand that in order for the individual cities to strive, to thrive in the region, they also need to take care of themselves. So Hartford has not made itself competitive in this region because we're not creating the quality of life that will attract people here. So I don't think high-speed rail is necessarily going to help Hartford until we start seeing Hartford as a place, or developing Hartford as a place that people want to be.
But that's a really important distinction. If we talk about Hartford as part of a mega region that is placed between the two great cities of Boston and New York, that's one way to think of what Hartford or New Haven or any Connecticut city should be. But you're talking about something different, which is Hartford or New Haven have to think about what they are as communities, what they want to be to provide the network of streets, but also just the things that people need for everyday life for that community. It is a very different way of thinking from this big collective that runs from one city to the next down to the very, very local.
Yes, that's the difficulty. We have to think at all the different scales. We can't just think on one. And for a long time, for the last few years in Connecticut, we have been talking about the mega region without understanding the importance of let me give you an example.
Sure.
If we had high-speed rail coming into Hartford, you would get to Union Station, and then there would be nowhere to go because we have no integrated transit for the metropolitan area. So that doesn't serve the interests of Hartford being part of a mega region. We need to consider the connections in Hartford, what is around this train station, what we're offering to people in the individual towns, and that's not what we're having in Hartford.
But it's always, I think, with planning or with design, there's a chicken and egg problem, right? Do you build some sort of a transit system and then hope that there's investment around it to give people places to shop, things to do, places to live, or do you build those things first and hope that the transit follows? When you're talking about infrastructure, it costs lots and lots of money,
right?
And so you need to spend money the right way. Is it chicken or egg, Norm?
Well, it's not... Well, I guess you could look at it in that way. But really, we can't sit and hope. We have to understand the connections. And that's always the difficulty in Connecticut, is to understand that things are about systems. It's not just a thing. We build a line. We build a stadium. We're always building things. We're not never considering how things integrate, how things fit together. And so we are constantly chasing our tail in that way.
Well, I'm wondering if you can give us an example from the research that you've done about this. If you were to fix a system or fix something about the way a place works, what would be something you'd put on the drawing board and say, this, municipal leaders, is something we should try?
Well, I've been thinking a lot about Hartford recently. The other day I went on a walk with one of my colleagues from UConn from Asylum all the way into the North End because to look at the stadium site.
And again, just for our listeners who aren't following this every day, this is a stadium that's proposed for minor league baseball. Rock Cats has been somewhat controversial. We've talked about it on the program before, but please continue. Yes.
Yeah, so what is needed to fix or to change how Hartford work is a lot of small interventions. It's about all that parking around the State House. It's about the streets. It's about, for example, in the West End, we have one of the best residential neighborhoods in the state. And yet there is no commercial strip. Farmington Avenue is a disaster. So trying to make those connections and those small interventions that would start to bring back life and community. I was just in Buffalo, and Buffalo is a basket case also, but it has some of the best residential neighborhoods with active commercial strips that we don't have in Hartford, and we're just starting to see in New Haven. So trying to work on those small moves that we can bring back a sense of community, a sense of life. And part of that is the transportation. Part of that is how the physical infrastructure, the streetscape, etc. All of those things, it's never been done on a concerted basis in Hartford.
It's interesting, and I will bring this back around to the beginning of the program in just the last couple of minutes. I started by saying that I grew up in the suburbs outside of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I love the city of Pittsburgh itself, and one of the reasons I love it is it's a city of neighborhoods. And you don't actually think when you go there about going to a specific event or mm-hmm. a big building. You think about going from one neighborhood to the next, and each neighborhood has its own little commercial strip and its places where you can live and a park, and that seems to be one of the threads. And sometimes, Norm, these just sprout up out of nowhere. An arts community will pop up over the course of a couple of years because some people just decide to invest in one area, and that's how they make something grow.
Yes, Pittsburgh is wonderful. I love a lot of the neighborhoods there. But, you know, it often seems as if things sprout from nowhere. But often the seeds have been planted by good planning, by good policy. And that's, again, is something that is often missing in Connecticut. So, you know, we have this idea that cities are for visiting. And I think one of the changes that we need to think about is how to make cities livable. And I think that would make a huge difference in how we think about investing and how we think about intervening to make our cities better. I should point out that I was recently at an event at UConn, and I asked the students, there were about 50 students, asked them, how many of you are going to stay in Connecticut? And nobody said yes. They were all talking about going to Boston and Chicago and D.C. And this is putting us in a really, really bad situation as we go forward, that our young people do not want to be here because we don't have the city life that can draw them here.
And as we started our conversation with Lee Gallagher, people moving out of suburbs, wanting a more urban, more vibrant community, young people especially, they're looking for that vibrancy. Maybe they're not finding it in Connecticut cities. Maybe that's something that gives us an opportunity, though, Norman, to take this research, to look at this and make something emerge in places like Hartford and Waterbury and New Haven, Bridgeport, places that traditionally have been struggling in the way that you've described.
We have an amazing opportunity. I remember being in Portland, Oregon, where everybody tout has been so wonderful. And I'm looking around Portland, I'm thinking, it doesn't have the architecture of Hartford. It doesn't have the style that Hartford could have. So, yes, we do have the opportunities here. The question is taking advantage of that, and we have not done that to date.
Norman Garrick is an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of Connecticut. He comes by to talk with us periodically about issues like planning and design, and it's a fascinating conversation that we will continue. Norman, it's always good to see you. Thank you for coming
in. Thank you very much.
Our program is produced by Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. The executive producer is Katie Tolarski. I'm John Dankosky. Please have a great weekend.